I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. As we mark the 100th anniversary of the armistice, I'm joined by Eric McGeer, who is the author of an upcoming book, Varsity's Soldiers, a look at the role of Canadian universities in military recruitment between 1914 and 1968. The Great War's significance on Canada, shaping it and its peoples, is important to consider as we mark this notable anniversary. I'll get Dr. McGeer to tell us about what Canada was like before, during, and after World War I, as well as how the country has come to commemorate it. We'll also discuss the losses and how that impacted so many people at home and abroad. Eric McGeer holds a PhD from the Université de Montréal, and he teaches at the School of Continuing Studies at the University of Toronto. He is the author of Canada's Dream Shall Be of Them, Words in Valediction and Remembrance, Canadian Epitaphs of the Second World War, as well as several books on warfare and law. Varsity's Soldiers will be available from the University of Toronto Press in April. Please welcome to the Plant on Line program in Toronto, Eric McGeer. Dr. McGeer, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So the First War, the Great War, it was quite a brutal war, and the losses were felt throughout the country and throughout society. A lot of the soldiers were quite young, too, is that right?
Oh, yes. That's the most heartbreaking thing, is that the relative age is in the early 20s, but many were much younger. Boys as young as 15 who were killed. The youngest British soldier of the war was thought to be less than 14 years old. So it's not only the great number of casualties, but the way that it had a terrible effect on a whole generation of young men in Britain, Australia, and Canada, around the world. That's the worst part of it all.
Yeah, not only, war does shape character and influence people. Those that fought in the war, these young men that you mentioned, but I guess it influences the people at home, especially, as well. And a lot of people talk about just how, how this shaped Canada.
Well, I think in many ways, the war was a tremendous ordeal, not only for the soldiers who fought in the trenches, that was bad enough, but I think it certainly changed the direction of many people's lives here in Canada, that all of a sudden, we think of the issue, let's say, of single motherhood. There are a lot of young women having to raise one, two, three, how many children on their own because their husband had gone overseas, or people coping with the shortage of labor, so that young women who might have followed a different career path went into the munitions factories or into agricultural work. Even children, for example, who were encouraged to join little knitting clubs or write letters to the soldiers or make their little contribution to the winning of the war. It certainly reached all the segments of the population, and so no one living in Canada at that time would have escaped some aspect of the war, whether as a fighting soldier or as one of the people here at home trying to cope with the pressures of the war, economizing, coal shortages, food shortages, and then, of course, the political and social divisions over things like conscription. It was a very divisive time as well, and a time of great strain and anxiety. So it's very hard for us to imagine that prolonged sense of the pressures of the war, the demands of the war, and, of course, the anxiety that someone you love very much might be reported killed. So I think we have to take into account the very things you're talking about, which is the general sense of the war, not just on the fighting soldiers, but on the populations that had to support that war for four very long years.
Yeah. So 1918, the end of the war, it's too simplistic for me to say that it was greeted well, the size of the losses on all sides, that had to be a relief that the end was here, right?
Well, I think that's probably the feeling that came first, was the tremendous sense of relief that by about 100 years ago today, let's say, just before November 11th, the anticipation was building that, in fact, the war might be coming to an end. And it took a lot of people by surprise because the governments had been planning for the war to go on into 1919 and 1920. And so, as you say, the arrival of the news that the war was coming to an end was a great relief as well as a great joy, but it was also a time of great anxiety here in Canada because that news came in the middle of the influenza epidemic when that was just sweeping through the population, that it wasn't as though there wasn't a great deal to cope with other than the news of the progress of the war. And I would say, too, that, you know, for Canadians, you know, we lost a great many people in the war. There's an astronomical total of 65,000 out of a population of just about 7 million. But for the defeated countries, and particularly for Germany, which lost nearly 2 million people, to lose that many people and lose the war, you know, that would have exacerbated, you know, beyond belief, there's a bitterness and anger at the end of the war in the way that it turned out that they had sacrificed so much and lost. At least for Canadians, there was something redemptive in the victory and the magnificent part that the Canadian Corps had played in bringing that victory to the Allies, so that some of the grief and anxiety was tempered in this country or in the victorious countries, where in the defeated countries it only made everything worse and then deeply embittering as it turned out.
Yeah, and so this question about whether the victory justified the sacrifice, I mean, that's something that you contend with, and you have contended with in your writing, is that right?
Yes, yes. And I think what I've tried to do, especially by looking at the commemoration in the 1920s and 1930s, and particularly at the epitaphs that were put on the headstones of Canadian soldiers who were killed in the war, that their families could contribute a short valedictory message. And often those are very revealing of the ways in which people accepted the loss of life, and in a way that they felt that the sacrifice and the effort had been worthwhile. And I think there was a British historian who made a very important point about this. He says that the First World War and how we assess it depends very much on where we are assessing it from the 1920s or from the 1960s or from today. And what we have to remember is that people at that time felt that the war was sadly but grimly necessary, and that it was about something. It was about stopping a militaristic and aggressive Germany that had violated Belgian neutrality, that threatened the security of Great Britain and her empire beyond the seas. The things in which people implicitly believed in that day and age, which we don't necessarily see the same way anymore. But to them, it was a cause, and I think as well when the Americans came into the war in 1917 with Woodrow Wilson and the 14 points, it gave the war more of a kind of a moral plane or a moral force that had been lacking before. And so the idea of creating a better world, a world that would not have war anymore, and that the post-war settlement would create a world in which such a thing could never happen again, was a deeply cherished belief on the part of those people. And the sad thing is, of course, they were disappointed in that belief that a war even worse than the First World War came along 20 years later. But if we try to see it from their vantage point, that it had been a terrible sacrifice, a terrible exertion, but the very consoling and, I think, very deep hope that it would lead to something better. So when we talk about the victory and the result of the First World War, I do think we have to separate ourselves from what we know, what happened, you know, as we look at it 100 years later, and try to situate ourselves in 1918 and 1919 and to understand how people would have viewed the result of the war and as a kind of a justification and basis for a better world that they so much hope to see. It was a naive hope, but I think it was a deeply sincere and deeply cherished one, and it's sadly to be disappointed.
Yeah, and so there was, 100 years ago, there was great hope as the war ended that the world would be better, right?
Yes, yes. That's, especially, let's say, with Woodrow Wilson and the American entry, as I was saying, that when he came out with the 14 points and he said there aren't going to be any more secret alliances, there's going to be national self-determination, we're going to get rid of all the things that led to this catastrophe in 1914, and there's going to be a sort of a new international order, and there's going to be the League of Nations, there are going to be all of these guardrails, in a sense, that will protect us from another war of this scope and destructiveness. And I think a lot of people place their hopes that such a thing was achievable. And it's one of the great ironies of the war that the Americans, in the end, did not join the League of Nations. They repudiated much of what Wilson was trying to achieve. And the war, in a sense, doesn't really lead to that kind of international revolution. And then, of course, in the 20s and the 30s, with the rise of the dictators and the threat of another world war, I think the disappointment and the disillusionment that we think of with the First World War begins to set in, because it didn't make things better. It led to circumstances that were proving to be appalling to contemplate. And when, of course, the Second World War started, it, in a sense, invalidates the First World War, because we have to do it all over again.
Mm. So when did Eric, November 11th become? I mean, it wasn't called Remembrance Day initially, right?
No, it was not. It was called the Armistice Day in Canada until 1931. And in fact, the reason why the Canadian Thanksgiving was moved to October was to get it out of the way of the November 11th commemoration, which began formally. The first services were actually held in 1919, but the shape of the Armistice Day or Remembrance Day ceremonies had taken shape by the early 1920s with the protocol that people are familiar with now, with the 2 minutes of silence and the singing of the national anthem. All of the sort of the order of service that we followed was well established in the 1920s, and it was a very, very solemn day. I remember reading when I was doing my research on the University of Toronto in that time, that the whole university would stop. Everybody would come to the University War Memorial, as would have been the case at all Canadian universities, uh-huh. And the absolute silence that reigned. The only thing they could hear was a bell at City Hall, which tolled out the 11th hour, but the solemnity and the silence of that occasion, because they could still remember a lot of those young men who had been their friends and companions at the university. So I think in the 1920s, when the memory of the war was still very fresh, there was a kind of profundity in those services which we could never hope to match again. But it's deeply moving to read about them, because it was deeply, deeply felt by all those who attended.
And it was necessary, wasn't it, that they needed to have these commemorations every year on that date?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was, as one scholar put it, was a national funeral is what it was. And for many of the families, of course, about a third of the Canadians killed in the First World War had no known grave, so the families did not have the consolation of a known and honored burial of someone they loved very much. And so these services, in a sense, replace the private grief that the family could not exercise at a funeral, at a formal farewell, and in a sense it becomes a kind of collective funeral for the country's fallen. And it was deeply important to many of the people who found this the only sort of public acknowledgement or recognition of the grief that they had suffered as a wife or as a mother or as a son or as a daughter. These were extremely important rituals to console and comfort the people who had not only, say the war not only killed so many people, but it obliterated so many people. You know, yeah. Half the British Empire dead or unidentified. So with that terrible sort of factor working into it, I think you can easily see the depth of meaning of the Remembrance Day services. It filled an extremely important spiritual and consolatory need for people at the time. I mean, your heart really goes out to them. That was a war that had been shocking beyond all belief, and it took a long time for people to reacclimatize themselves to their lives. It took them a long time to realize there was no going back to the world before 1914, that war had been such a terrible rupture in the life of themselves, of the country, of their society. So that made Remembrance Day perhaps the most solemn day of the year, even more than Easter.
Yeah. And so how has that day and the commemorations of on November 11th, how have those changed over the years? I mean, I'm sure the war, the second war, beginning in 1939, I mean, that obviously changed that experience going forward, right?
Yes. I think the Second World War, the Remembrance Day ceremonies were somewhat eclipsed during that time, the war on, and we weren't going to commemorate the first when we were busy with the second. But I think ever since 1945, of course, the Remembrance Day services have been expanded to the remember the dead of two wars, not just one. And, of course, we don't have anybody left from the First World War. There can't be more than a very, very few people alive who have any living memory of the First World War, and, of course, they would have been,
children
at the time.
Yeah.
So it's gone from living memory into historical memory, and I think the immediacy of Remembrance Day is not as acute in people's minds. So it becomes more of a commemoration of a historical event than, I think, direct remembrance of the people who were involved in it. But I think as a national acknowledgement of the sacrifice and efforts of earlier generations of Canadians. I think it's the one day in the year where the country can come together and take a few minutes and think about what our ancestors went through, and to try and show the kind of human sympathy across time that I think we have to show to those that came before us, and show some understanding of the trials and tribulations of their lives and appreciation for the suffering and for the achievements that, again, what the Canadian Corps did in the First World War won the admiration of the world. I think we can be justifiably proud of the courage and resilience and the achievements of the soldiers of that time who brought victory to a populace that desperately needed it. So that I think all of those things can combine in the service, which is now more historical than personal, but I think as important to us in our way as it was to them in their way. And I hope that the centenary will promote a kind of reflection or a kind of attempt to go back to that time, to sort of get back in the shoes of the people who lived at that time and understand something of what that ordeal was and how they faced it, and how these are the people who built the country and passed it on to us, and we owe them a debt of remembrance and a debt of gratitude for that.
So those are the things you're thinking about when it's November 11th, not only coming up, but year after year, right?
Yeah, I think year after year. I think many of your listeners will have had, a father or grandfather in one of the wars. I mean, one of the things that has really struck me about the commemorations of Canada's role in the First World War is all the families who are discovering letters or artifacts and so forth from grandparents, from great-grandparents who were in the war or the Second World War. So there's a family history sometimes that's being put back together, and I think with that, the awareness of the magnitude of those events, and I think when we, on Remembrance Day, I myself, because I've been interested in the field for a very long time, just try to imagine the human experience of the war. I remember you were talking to Tim Cook a couple of weeks ago, and he wrote that really wonderful book on the secret history of soldiers. Mm-hmm. And just how they got through it. I think that the lived experience of the war and the very human ways in which these guys tried to cope with that, and then, of course, the way their families back at home tried to keep up morale and cope with all of the demands and pressures and shortages of the war, I think the human sympathy that we should feel towards people who've gone through a great trial comes back on Remembrance Day, and I think it makes us more thankful that we live in a time when we're not threatened by that, that our lives are just so much more secure and so much more comfortable than that generation's was. And I think we should be very thankful for that. It's a chance to sort of count our lucky stars as well, that we don't have to go through that ourselves.
Yeah, and there are great lessons, too, in terms of not just character that we can derive from 100 years ago that'll help us with the problems of today, if you will.
Well, I think that's very true. I think it does lend that perspective that we can think very much of what character and what the values of that society were and how they defined it and tried to shape it. And it might contrast in different ways of our own, but I think it's a very useful area of comparison. And I think it's very important in history to see the past as made up by living people who were guided by certain values or certain beliefs that we may no longer hold in as high esteem, but that, I think, sheds light on our own and why we believe what we believe and act as we act, that one day will be history too, and we hope that it will be as fair to us as we're trying to be to them. And I think, too, the example of courage and fortitude and perseverance that population showed is very important for us to remember. That was the hardest time in Canadian history, I think, by a mile, even more than the Second World War. And I just admire the endurance of those people to get through that and try and build something better out of the ruins of the war. So many soldiers came back determined to make the country a better country, whether they went into various professions or they went into the universities or they went into politics, hoping that the fact that they had been spared meant something, that they had been spared in order to do something productive for the country or for society as a whole, which is a very admirable response to that tragedy. We think of all the prominent Canadians who went through the First World War, John Diefenbaker and Lester Pearson, Frederick Banting, the guy who advanced insulin, had been a surgeon during the First World War. I think they all came back with the idea that they needed to do something to redeem the horror of the war by doing something productive and constructive when they got home. again, it's deeply admirable on their part.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eric, you have a forthcoming book, Varsity Soldiers, and in that you talk about the role that Canadian universities had in military recruitment. Was that, say, unknown heretofore, or at least understated?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, I think it's kind of an opening field. I think that's been one of the areas that's been overlooked is the role of Canadian universities, both in the First World War and in the Second. And if there are any history students listening up in British Columbia, I think they should take a good long look at the UBC archives, because the University of British Columbia had a very active officer training corps during the First World War and during the interwar period, and then again in the Second World War. And some of the most prominent people in the history of the University of British Columbia, and I think he's a man named Gordon Shrum, who was in physics, I think, and science at UBC for a long time, and was the first chancellor of Simon Fraser University.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the First World War. He served at Vimy Ridge. He came back, completed his education, and went on to serve the university both as a teacher and as somebody who took care of the officer training corps at the UBC, which he felt was a very important part of the university's sort of contribution to the civic and military welfare of Canada. So I think there are lots of opportunities there to look at the universities. And the University of Toronto had a very active military history that goes back to the 1860s, because many of these universities had infantry companies that were, in a sense, a kind of extracurricular at the time, but it was also the university's contribution to the defense of Canada when most of the cities had militia regiments like the Seaforth Highlanders of Vancouver, the same way we have them here in Toronto, that it was a professional association as well as a military one, and often it would connect you with lawyers and bankers and doctors and so forth in the city, so it was kind of a rung up on the social and professional network as well. But when the First World War came, the university felt that the university students, given the fact that they were educated and were, in a sense, the intellectual cream of the country, should be the ones to lead in battle. And so they formed these officer training corps overnight when the war began, and began to take students in to prepare them for the roles of junior officers in combat. And then as the war went on, they began to look at them in a different way, to say that they had the expertise that was required by the increasingly technical aspect of the war, whether it was in artillery or tanks or airplanes or submarines and so forth, that as the technical development of the war proceeded, the universities became a kind of seedbed for the young men who had the technical or educational backgrounds to cope with the demands of an increasingly technological war. And that was even more true in the Second World War. So the university's role in many ways, both in sort of manpower and brain power, was very, very important in both wars, especially in the Second. And that eventually reaches into to the female students, who play a somewhat more limited role in the First World War, but then in the Second World War there are a corps or other sorts of organizations created so that the women can make a contribution, whether in industry or in the labor force, or perhaps in the medical corps or in the auxiliary corps, so that the Second World War universities include all of the student population, male and female, to get them behind the war effort as an important resource for the country as a whole. So it's a very rich history, and as I say, I would strongly encourage any history students out there to start looking at that, because it's a relatively unfilled field, but it's full of fascinating details and fascinating people, and it's a very important part of the history of Canadian universities, which I think up until now has been somewhat overlooked, but to say a very, very fertile field for further study.
Well, you will come on, I hope, when the book comes out in the spring. To discuss that, because from what I've heard just now, it is a fascinating subject, especially what you've uncovered there in Toronto.
Well, I think it's all interconnected. That, for example, in the University of Toronto files, there's a lot of correspondence from the University of British Columbia, because all the universities were talking to each other about their different programs. And so it shows a side of a Canadian university experience that I think would lead to a very different and, I think, renewed appreciation of the role that universities generally have played in Canada, and the way in which military and other kinds of education were combined on campuses until the late 1960s, when the university companies were finally abolished. But it's a very interesting chapter in Canadian educational and military history that I think, you know, they would would be very interesting to anybody who was a graduate of the University of British Columbia, for example, or a graduate of any of the universities that had these programs to understand a very important part of their university's past. And I was a student at the University of Toronto back in the 1970s. I had no idea of any of this. And as I started to do the research, I realized just how vast this subject was. So out of that kind of experience, I hope that others, young scholars, might have it as well, because it's just a wonderful subject to study.
Indeed. Eric, we'll talk again in the spring, I hope. And until then, I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
You're very welcome, Joseph. Thank you very much for having me.
The book Varsity Soldiers will be available in spring 2019 from the University of Toronto Press. Dr. Eric McGeer joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.